Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Satsang with G. Awfully happy, very just delighted that you're all here. As always, I'm just very honored to be able to do this, to just be able to. It's always really quite a miracle to me to be able to get in front of people and share what's been, the things that I've been given in my life, and share them with others and realize they're valuable to others as well. A quote from a Zen master comes to mind where he said, "I've spent my whole life selling water, standing by a river," and that's really what it feels like. You know, we're here to help each other realize our own truth, and the real truth, the genuine truth, lies within us. It's not a set of ideas. It's not a philosophy. It's not a political or economic stance. It is not even really a religion, right? Things like that grow out of it, but that's not what they essentially are. What they essentially are, what it essentially is simply the reality of our true being, who you really are, which is something that's experienced not intellectually, but directly. Something that doesn't go through the mind, but goes through the heart. Sorry for there's a little extra background noise here today that I don't normally have, and I'm not quite sure what's causing it, but not much I can do about it, so let's press on. And special thanks to the people at BBS Radio for putting this on, and also for those of you who may be hanging on after the Shri and Kira show. I decided this week to change the subject I was going to talk about. In the light of the events, I had several requests of people to ask me about the events, a spiritual perspective of the events that have taken place in Charlottesville, and other acts of racism and bigotry and the like. And I'm not a political commentator. all the politicians like to get it to stand up and make their pitch and the like, and the fallout from that, and the criticism of our president for acting so slowly, and then just not really condemning the act. And lots of leaders around the world said nothing, and others were very strong about it. And I mean, we need to face it, the differences between us, and they run deep, but they're exacerbated simply because of the times that we're in. It's people don't become violent or that self-centered unless they feel threatened. And there's an increasing polarity amongst people. There's an increasing sense of insecurity, an increasing sense that we're not really being, that the system is failing us, and we want to reach out and just kind of lash out at the people we think are responsible for it. And of course, there's always, people in power that are ready to put the blame on everybody except who's really to blame. And I'm not going to go into any kind of tome about my particular leanings on the subject. I always want to look at it from the point of view of what is it? Whenever anything happens, it's never isolated. I mean, it's like things just don't pop out of nowhere. Every event that occurs is arising out of a set of conditions that exists, and those conditions became ripe for certain things to emerge and seem plausible and reasonable and useful to whoever experiences it. I mean, Buddha pointed that out 2,600 years ago. Nothing exists in isolation from something else. I mean, it's not really, a powerful statement to say, well, there's blame on both sides. Well, that's not really useful. It's not really helpful. There's a polarity that has taken place. And people don't get angry or enraged unless they feel threatened. If you look at the actual physiological functioning of anger, and when it gets extreme form, which is rage, it is the fight side of the flight and fight mechanism, which is inherent in the human being. The feeling, the physiological changes, and the feeling that takes place when we are threatened, is either going to be to flee, and that feeling is fear, or if really pushed, it's going to be to fight, and that feeling and the sensations and the whole physiology that go with it is anger. Anger simply does not occur without a feeling of powerlessness. And that does go everywhere, and that does go on all sides. And then when somebody's in that state, remember, when you're in fight or flight, creativity is shut down, higher reasoning is shut down, critical thinking is shut down. Everything other than the survival mechanism is active. You cannot think clearly. You can't do it. So you can't reason things out. It's like when you have a cold, all the energy of the body is gone to fighting off the cold. So there's not a whole lot left for, doing stuff and being creative and making stuff happen. I mean, you're barely there. You're just kind of laying around bored because you simply don't have the energy to do it. And when it passes, that energy comes back. This is no different. It sucks the energy out of all of our higher capacities, and we really do become reduced. We become less than what we can possibly be. And if we get stuck in that position, we'll just be clinging to anything, blaming anything, just trying to get out of that feeling of being deeply threatened and powerless, to be powerless is to be facing death. And that's what it is. But more and more of us are in that state. More and more of us are being pushed into that. So I call this episode The End of Conflict. Is it possible to end conflict? Well, as always, I urge people to first direct their attention inward. Because if we don't meet our own inner conflict first, we too will be at least partially incapacitated when it comes time to have to deal with someone who may be even more incapacitated than you, who's not capable of engaging in a reasonable conversation. An animal that is up against the wall is not going to be reasoned with. I mean, it has one thing on its mind. It will do whatever it takes to get out of that. And that's what we become. We really become partially and sometimes predominantly incapacitated. So first we have to reclaim that territory for ourselves. It's why I put so much emphasis on inner reconciliation, because to me it's the antidote for inner conflict. We are in conflict with ourselves all the time. The cause of our inner conflict goes back to our early childhood. And if you're a believer in such things, even beyond this life, it has a life that goes into the deep past, and some things go from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime, if you buy that. If you don't, just going to our early childhood is enough. And remember, when you are a child, you are powerless. You are utterly vulnerable. Up to a certain age, you don't have a chance in hell of surviving on your own. You are completely dependent upon your tribe. And in the beginning, I mean, you're little more than an appendage growing in your mother's body. I mean, you can't do anything for yourself. And so that sense of vulnerability is deep. And the body and the nervous system knows that the only thing that matters is staying on the good side of your parents. And if anything you do, anything at all, earns their disfavor or diminishment, even mildly, you know, let alone severely, like an abuse or something like that. It challenges that sense. It makes that feeling of vulnerability acute because it's tied directly to the fear of death. And of course, being powerless, they have all the power, you have none. They must be right and you must be wrong. So whatever you do has to change to accommodate them. Now, very often, the thing that triggered their anger or their disappointment or whatever pushback they gave you, well, it's all innocent, right? Children don't do anything that isn't natural to them. They're not editing yet. They have to learn how to do that. So in the beginning, everything is just you. It's just pure. It's just innocent. It's just good. But even though it's totally natural, totally, totally, totally wonderful, really, pure, innocent, just pure goodness, it will run into the rules and mores and regulations and ideas and belief systems of the tribe, which will denounce it in some way. Which means expressing yourself as you are naturally, which you can't help but do, literally gets associated with having your life threatened. So the quality which is totally you and is totally your nature to express now becomes dangerous. It's a remarkably amazing circumstance that we find ourselves in. And of course, if it was just a regular threat, like something coming to get you, the normal fight or flight would take over. But the threat is coming from those whose charge it is to take care of you. You cannot flee, and you cannot fight. And that is when a trauma is created. And that essential trauma creates a conflict with ourselves. I take it a step farther than most psychologists do, in that I see that trauma now is simply an incapacity to be able to express that which is your nature. It's like, trying to pretend your hair isn't growing. You can't do it except you're trimming it back all the time. So, hey, is that hair growing? No, it's not growing. I mean, it really is that natural, our natural capabilities. But this is the domestication, the socialization that we all go through. And it is crippling to us. We know we have compromised something deep. That's why it's such a powerful trauma. It is the essential trauma. And if you want to look at it more spiritually, it is that which is the foundation, the seeds of what will become the sense of being a separate self, the sense of being separate from the world. And out of that will grow a totally fabricated and imaginary sense of identity to inhabit that and to make sure that what gets presented to your tribe always gets back from the tribe, that which keeps you safe, takes care of your needs, gives you what the love and attention that you absolutely must have. And anything else, no matter how natural and beautiful and right it is for you, if it invokes that sense of danger, it's down in the basement. It is pushed away, and layers of behavior are created to sit on top of it to keep it from coming out. Those layers of behavior eventually become the false sense of self. They also become the source of our sense of inner conflict, because they are basically robbing us of our gifts. I mean, if you're a very creative child and you grew up in a family that's quite dull and has no appreciation of art or music or any of those kinds of things, the capacity, creativity will be discouraged. Anything in the arts will be discouraged. Creativity will be diminished. Those your little pictures won't be up on the refrigerator. That was actually my experience. somehow I managed to push through and become a musician anyway, probably out of just sheer rebellion. That, you know, seeing the Beatles and all the girls screaming for them. So what does this have to do with what's going on in the world? Well, everybody's gone through that. And because of our, and that original trauma, you know, to me, it's trauma numero uno. It is the first. I believe that that is what is meant in the story of Adam and Eve by the fall. That is the moment where we are basically kicked out of Eden, kicked out of the Garden of Paradise. And everything we do from that point on is going to be to compensate for that. And everything we do from that point on is going to be a grasping of something to hold on to, because the whole of you isn't there. And with that comes the fear of the fear of not only of death, but of lack, of not being enough, of not being good enough. And that's when we start pretending, we start acting, we start assuming identities, we start conforming, or we start rebelling. It can go in either direction. But the only real solution is to regain what is lost. And those really blessed beings who have come to the point where they have resolved that and come back to themselves and released that energy, worked through all that stuff and rediscovered their power, don't take fundamentalists' positions. They're not polarized. They're peacemakers, of which Christ said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." And there is no higher calling for someone than to be a peacemaker. But how do you be a peacemaker with somebody who's threatening violence against you? And I'm not trying to diminish the intensity of this for anybody. I have very close friends of mine that are black and that are gay, and I know the kind of things they have gone through that I, as a white male growing up in America, never ever experienced. There is a very subtle undercurrent of a white entitlement. It is still very real, and I can see it because I cannot fathom what it would be like to just be driving down a street and be pulled over and threatened for absolutely no reason. I can't imagine what it would be like to go to a movie theater, holding hands with somebody that I'm with, being affectionate with somebody I'm with, and having people yell at me or throw something at me. I can't conceive it. Right? And yet I know it's happened. I know it has happened not that long ago. And it's still happening now. So I'm not proposing this as, you know, this some sort of Pollyannish thing. But I know that at the essence, the cause of the entire thing is this alienation from oneself. And that ultimately you can't fight fire with fire. Violence against violence will not work. Even the strongest condemnations will not work. They will only polarize more. We have exhausted all the ways in which we think we have been able to deal with this. So we have to explore others. We have to explore deeply in our own hearts. We have to find that in us that still feels like it's entitled, that it still feels like it is incomplete, that still feels like it needs to get from others, that it doesn't want to benefit others, that still feels so lacking that it needs to grab and hoard for its own purposes. And this is, you know, this is as common for somebody who's, you know, who'd be out on the street or marching for a, you know, for a statue of the Confederate flag or something, or the wealthy, the extremely wealthy, who is completely out of touch with the rest of the world and feels entitled to what they have somehow they They deserve it. This runs the gamut, folks, all the way up and down. And so the answer is not, it's not easy if you rely completely on your mind to figure out some kind of strategy or tactic for dealing with it. We will have a temporary thing at best. A complete transformation of consciousness is required. I deeply believe that is, in fact, what is happening. I think that is what the real energy that is pushing all of this nasty stuff to the surface is. And so I, because I feel so strongly that the answer lies within each one of us, at least first. You know, I'm not saying don't protest or don't go out and join organizations. Don't listen to brilliant political speakers and the like, like Vilke, like Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges and Howard Zinn and really brilliant people who are looking at this very closely, and others. There's plenty out there. But what I am saying is that that's not going to be enough, because the energy that will actually find that fine middle road that finally relieves enough of the fear of lack on all sides that a peacemaking can take place, that some place can happen where people can feel like to compromise is to die. So let's look at that inner conflict. And it's not really hard to see. People are joining all the time. Thank you. So good to see you here. And I should also point out that if you'd like to call in and ask me a question, and speak with me personally, the number is 888-627-6008. That's not the number for listening, if you want to listen on your phone, which you can. That number, 888-627-6008, is to speak. And my producer, Doug, will tell me that I've got somebody, and he'll patch you through when the time happens. So let's do a little. I know we got a lot of. I had a lot of questions. I'm on 23 already. A lot of questions before this this whole thing even started, and some about the record, the meditations that were at the beginning. Which would be a promotional thing at this time, which I don't think is appropriate. So I'm not going to talk about it. I invite you to actually just look in your own life, look at the events of your life. Anyone, any event that was memorable enough that you still remember it, and where you were having to make a decision about something, and you didn't quite know what to do, and you felt that conflict. What am I going to do? Wanting to know what the right thing was to do, and going back and forth and back and forth. The two poles to which you were going back and forth, between which. What were those? What were those poles? It just gets kind of blurred when we're looking at it. Oh, it's just to say I could do this or I could do this. Well, why were they so equal? Why is the horizon so flat that one of them? Eventually, one of them became the winner. Maybe something else popped up. I'm willing to bet that if you look really closely, whenever there's some kind of conflict like that, it's what you're going to discover is that the conflict was between safety and freedom. We were reaching for freedom. We were holding to freedom. We really wanted. Otherwise, what's the decision? You're trying to do something new in your life. You're trying to make something happen. You're trying to decide on a course of action that's going to be important, that's going to set you on a trajectory that in some cases, in some cases, there's no coming back from, you know, like having a child, you know, there's certain, you know, moving, there's, you know, every decision we make creates a new trajectory, and there's really no going back, right? Even if you went back, it's not the same place anymore. As they say in Zen, you can't stick your foot in the same river twice. Right? Everything you do has that level of profound impact. But because we want that so much, we want to have that sense of freedom, any kind of inner resistance to it. I mean, if it was just nothing but freedom, you just do it. You wouldn't think about the consequences. I want it. Oh, there it is. You just go out and grab it. You know, you're tired of your job. Yeah, screw it. And you'd leave. I quit now. Ciao. You just pick up your things and go. You would have no, you'd not think about the consequences. Now you think, well, gee, that's crazy. You have to think about it. But that's only because you've melded these two things into your mind as if they were the same thing. They're not. They're two very different energies. One is the innate and deeply significant drive we humans have to be free, to recover the lost territory, to expand, to grow, to explore, to find new territories, to make new things, to create art and literature and beauty. And at the same time is the irreversible and irrevocable drive to survive. And as far as safety is concerned, as far as the need to survive is concerned, all change is bad. All change is unacceptable. Now, when your nervous system has, you know, worked for a long time to map an environment, and it's got all the right behaviors together, and it's got the right actions and the right words, and it knows everything to do, it knows exactly how to survive in the environment that it's in, the last thing it wants you to do is to change that environment, because then it's going to have to go through the process again. And it cannot guarantee that in the new place you're going to be, it's going to be able to keep you safe. And so it will resist change. That's why every single progressive thing you seek to do, there will be a feeling of resistance behind it. I want you to understand that, because this is the essential conflict in a human being. And actually, it's elaborate. There's more parts to us than that. And it gets bigger, and I try to cover all of them in inner reconciliation. But you can break it down to those two. Those are very easy to see. And eventually, somehow a negotiation or a domination happens so that one side wins. And then once that one side wins, your mind will kick in and make up all sorts of stories about how it was the right thing to do, rationalize and justify the entire thing so it feels like it was the right decision. Unless, of course, it doesn't lead to where you want it to lead, in which then you start beating yourself up for not making the right decision. Go all the way back to that first moment. What if we could completely and totally embrace the fact that there was no getting around the desire, the intense desire for freedom, and the irrevocable drive to survive? If the two of these energies were never, ever going to agree, but they could be brought into a reconciliation, then what? You see, the solution to, you know, for many, is for things to never change, right? And if somebody is really, really, most of the time siding with safety, they're going to become narrow, they're going to be uncreative, they're going to be intellectually dull, they're not curious, they won't challenge beliefs, because it's a threat. Somewhere along the line, that taste for freedom and the feeling of being constricted has got to become loud enough that there's a willingness to endure a little bit of the discomfort that's necessary to actually stick your foot in the water, take a peek and see, is it, this is really unsatisfying. I really do want to get someplace else. I don't know how to do it. I've never done it. What am I going to do? But where I am right now just isn't acceptable anymore. I just can't do it. It's got to get to that point. As long as there is as long as the that desire for freedom isn't at least a little bit greater than the need for safety, there'll be no progress made. The only time anything will change is if something externally in the environment forces it to happen. This is actually what's happened. We had a great deal of stability, economic stability, especially in the United States for quite a while, and that started to break down in the 80s. And it's gotten increasingly so. And so those who weren't really driven towards the kind of creative and expressive freedom that I'm talking about, the deeper freedom, the higher things, the self-actualization, if you want to use Maslow's terms, were very content that things the way where they were. Well, things aren't the way they were. You know, many of us went beyond that in the whole self-help movement and personal development and consciousness movement. There was like this an awakening that there was possibility for more, that we could actually do more, that how we think and feel and act is actually influencing the experience we're having in our lives. This means we could be more and do more. We could have expectations and discover the magic of learning, the magic of insight and these kinds of things. And therefore, we were also feeling the same discomfort. Everyone who went through that path feels that same discomfort of change. But now the cause of the discomfort is actually coming from you. It's coming from that drive to freedom, which has actually grown and expanded and got enough attention that it got nurtured. For many who never tasted that, who never wanted that, they're still really in a primitive state where only the external changes forced upon them are going to invoke the kind of suffering that would make one reach for something new. And of course, the first thing that happens, if you don't have a history of actually being interested or curious about such things, is you're going to retrench. You're going to want to fight to maintain the borders. And if you feel threatened enough, you will get violent. That's what happens. So again, I point you back to this conflict that's in you. What we're seeing in the world is a magnification of what happens in every single one of us. And to really come to terms with it and to solve this for ourselves gives you the authority, the power, the compassion, and most importantly, the wisdom as to how to make this more apparent and bring this to the rest of the world. I mean, I'm often asked as a spiritual teacher, why aren't you more political? And, you know, I came from a very political family. My family was very, I mean, every time everybody got together, it went on and on and on. And they were not moderates. They were extremes. Extreme right-wingers, by the way. And so, you know, political, very highly charged emotional political conversations were the norm in my house, and self-righteous indignation, along with bigotry and racism and all of the things, you know, not so with some very overt and very aggressive about it. Others just more that subtle, we're better because we're white kind of thing. I mean, that was just pervasive within my household. So why aren't you more political? Well, because the answer isn't out there. What's going on out there is a reflection of in here. And a lot of people say, well, is this kind of spirituality, is this really going to help the world? What else is? If we do not address the fundamental assumptions that are, for most people, are hidden, upon which our entire world is based. The entire world has a certain set of assumptions that it is based on. Those assumptions are creating, those are the causes and conditions that give rise to everything we are seeing. If we don't challenge those assumptions, if they're always in place, they're just going to change form. I don't care what you do to this, the structures and the institutions up here. If the next one is built on the same assumption, it's going to be more of the same. It's going to be the same thing. As Woody Allen said in the movie Sleeper, as he was stealing the nose of the president of this particular country, they didn't want to know he was dead, and they were going to try to clone him. He says, they said, well, you should be the president. He said, well, I'm the president. Well, then they're going to steal my nose and they're going to try to clone me. I mean, it's endless. It just goes on and on and on because it's all being produced by the same roots. And those roots are this inner conflict with ourselves, these fundamental assumptions about the nature of our, of who we actually are. And so While I always urge people to act, I mean, I've marched in protests and things like that, and I will again, right? I'm never denying any of that kind of stuff, but I realize that the only real power, the only real effectiveness, is that if we, as those who are deeply committed to the spiritual path, plunge in and penetrate into the depths of the assumptions upon which humanity's current state is are based. And if we get to those and we alleviate them, if you change it there, everything changes from that point on. Everything growing out of it is going to have to be different. As Christ said, does a fountain send forth at the same place both sweet water and bitter? It can't. We're going to create the fountain that's putting out the sweet water. And that means, in addition to all the things we do to try to just be better in the world, to have more conversation, be more open and tolerant, to listen and not immediately take sides, to not rankle, and at the same time, engage deeply within ourselves to resolve these kinds of conflicts so that we can look with others with compassion, realizing that we're all the same. You know, the boat they happen to be, you know, stuck in is maybe a different boat, but you were stuck in a boat too. And if we can recognize that, the differences will disappear, the similarities become so obvious that the idea of us fighting with each other over these things will become just unthinkable. It'll just fade. It'll just fade. What was that? Like it was a bad dream. So anyway, again, 888-627-6008. Let me see if there are any questions that are coming up. That's very funny. I had a question before. Let's see over here if anybody's asking a question. I know it's kind of a powerful topic, and it wouldn't surprise me if there weren't any. Right this second, but let me make sure. Somebody said yes, it had to be uncovered in order to be healed, and I'm glad you used the word healed. You know, rather than these guys got to be set straight. Yeah, they do. I mean to think for some reason that your race is superior than another race. Well, it just contradicts logic. I mean, it just contradicts logic. We all, if you do a DNA test, you'll find so many races in there. Your head's going to spin. You're going to realize you're not pure. You know, you just happen to be in a certain condition, a certain environment. Your body looks a particular certain way. Eve was black, by the way. I mean, to anybody, you know. Now, I know there are people religiously who do not believe in evolution, that God made us this way, and that's kind of a different discussion. But if you have any kind of ideas about DNA, we're a mix. And actually, the more we mix, the better it is. The more, the more the mix of the qualities. And this is so evident, especially in culture. How many of us don't like rock and roll and jazz and blues? I mean, all of our modern music came from the blacks, came from them singing their particular energy, their particular spirit, singing the only music they were allowed to sing at the time, which was the hymns of the white people. If it wasn't for them, we'd all be dancing those stupid little minuets, with powdered wigs on our heads. So we owe them a big debt of gratitude. But, you know, if we realize just the incredible benefit and wonder that we can bring to each other and not be pitted against each other, which is actually being manipulated, but that's a whole other story. And so I like the fact that when you say that, you said, so it can be healed. And I really ask you, what does healing mean? To heal means to become whole. It means to become full. It derives from health and wealth, actually, derive from the same word, which is wellness. It's a return to normalcy. It's a return to our natural state. That's what healing actually is. And our natural state is childlike. Now, as you've heard me say a lot of times, what we're going through right now, we have to go through. I'm not one of these people that says we need to return to different times, or, you know, the childhood state was perfect, we need to return to that innocence. We can't. Well, the childlike state, it's like that of an animal. It's pure, it's undifferentiated, they're 100% themselves. But if we don't pass through this period where there's some degree of separation from that that takes place, we never get to fulfill the journey. And the journey is awakening. The journey is reawakening to the undifferentiated consciousness, but now with the full conscious awareness of it. And that's how the sage gets born. And that is real healing. That's the real journey we're on. And my deepest faith, my deepest conviction, I say faith, not like I hope it's going to happen, my faith that it is happening, is that expansion of the truth of our being is the real catalyst behind all of this, pushing all of this to the surface, that it is pure love, pure truth, pure beingness that is pushing all of this stuff to the surface. And it's happening to us individually, and it's happening to the world as a whole. It's apocalyptic. You know, I'm not sure if I don't really believe that the apocalypse from the Bible is, you know, this horrible war and the Antichrist and all of that, except if you look at it mythologically as representing states of mind, representing aspects of the egoic mind, of its tyrannical nature, of its despotic nature. And we don't have to look any farther than ourselves to see that, to see how contradictory and despotic our own egos are. If somebody says something about you, how quickly we rankle. You know, if somebody pushes you on something, you'll take a position you don't actually even believe in just so you might make them right. I remember once in the gym after I was a workout. I'm living in San Francisco at the time, and we're at the height of a drought. And I started shaving, and I completely forgot, you know, the drought, and I had the water running as I'm shaving. And the guy next to me points out and says, you know, there's a drought going on. And I completely ignored him, and I left it on anyway. It was like something inside me just rankled. And after I was done, and he'd left, and I was walking out, I go, why the hell did I do that? He was right, of course. I should have shut the damn thing off. I should have said, thank you for reminding me. but instead, I was like, no, you're not going to tell me what to do. I mean, it was like so petty and so small. This is us, folks. This is the ego. This is what it is. It's a brat. Just, you know, get over it. It's a brat. This is what it is. This is what it's going to do. And there's no way out. But to actually see that means you have the opportunity to go beyond it. You know, when you're still caught in the middle of it, if I just went muttering myself, yeah, no, it's, or I even started listening, there's no drought going on. It's all a plot. There's nothing wrong with the climate. It's all a left wing hoax. If I found all sorts of information to fulfill my egoic idiocy, I'd never be able to see how limited and small and petty and constricting it actually is. One has to open themselves up for that. One has to be able to see. And so I always invite, take a look. Look at yourself. You want to understand bigotry? Look at your own bigotry. You want to understand unreasonableness? Look at your own unreasonableness. Really, honestly look at all the places where you have been or could be unreasonable, all the positions you feel are a must that absolutely must be taken, everything that you're not willing at all to compromise on, everything you think is absolutely true, look at all of them. It's not that you're going to find all of them are bogus and you're going to suddenly find yourself, you know, completely switching sides on any kind of issue or anything. It's not like that. You're just discovering that we tend to run our lives based on unchallenged assumptions. And when we do that, we pay a terrible price. We cut ourselves off from that pure energy of goodness that we actually are. Now, let's see if anybody else has got some questions here. What's your understanding of karma in Buddhism? Well, there's all sorts of different ways of looking at it. And, you know, in line with the conversation today about the end of conflict, you know, our conflicts, the energies we create, you know, some of them, they last a lot. Sometimes some energy you create, you know, lasts a day or two, sometimes lasts a week. You know, you can have anger and grudges you can hold for your whole life. Families can be perpetuated. Well, it's not hard to imagine that some of these things could actually be perpetuated over lifetimes, and that the energy of one could actually pick up in another. I mean, it's clear that we come in with certain characteristics, certain energies, certain proclivities, right? Every child does. They seem to react differently. Some of those things are clearly just the particular configuration of this form for this life. Others, they just seem to feel as if they've been here before. They've come around before. There are some energetic vows people can make that can last for lifetimes. I know I think it's the Hare Krishna, if you get married in the Hare Krishna church, you are married for 7 lifetimes. That's a powerful vow. That's a very powerful vow, especially when it has behind it that kind of conviction. I've worked with people, and really I've discovered some things in myself as well, who past lives made, you know, vows of poverty, vows of celibacy, you know, they were part of a clergy of some sort. You know, lived very monkish monk lives of self-imposed deprivations. These kinds of vows are sacred vows. You don't break them, period. And so you devote your entire life to that. When you devote your life to anything, that is a powerful energy. And that's not going to stop just because the body collapses. Now, there's a deeper perspective we can take on that, one that I urge people to take, because there's something even bigger than karma. There's something that once seen, it is the doorway out of all karma. Because if you look closely at karma, you find that you cannot not make it. Everything you do has its repercussions. Everything you do has an effect. And so cause and effect are perpetual. There's, you know, Buddha once said, you brush against somebody on the street and you have just created karma with them for 500 lifetimes. He used that phrase, 500 lifetimes, a bunch. He wasn't really referring to lifetimes, but he was really trying to draw the point that to try to just get better karma, get better merit, you know, for the next life was a waste of time. I mean, it's just not going to, there's too many things going on. You just can't do it. It isn't the way out. The way out was very different. The way out came through awakening. And the awakening was to the you really are, which is outside of karma, which is the consciousness that's been aware of the karma all along, the real consciousness that you are. So while it's like I could get seduced into believing I was a certain person in this life because of various kinds of experiences, there's no reason why I couldn't seduced into thinking I'm all of these different people. Maybe it's a sequence of dreams. And I would just ask, you know, if it's a dream, who wakes up when it ends? That's the question I would like answered. I'd like you to answer for yourself. When the dream ends, who wakes up? We think of ourselves as, oh, I'm going to awaken. I'm going to experience the awakening. Okay. Does the guy on TV change the channel? Do the characters in the book conspire to write the ending and try to hide it from the author? You know, you in a dream, you put yourself into that. You are whoever you are in that dream. You're having all the experiences. You're them. And then you wake up and you weren't them. It'd be similar, but you weren't that. So, who wakes up when it ends? It is not who you think you are. Who you think you are is the dream and the dreamer. let's see. The end of conflict equals the end of suffering, right? Wow. Somebody, either you watched my webinar or you got what to me is the absolute obvious, and that is, yeah, that's the cause of suffering. The end of conflict. And that doesn't contradict the Buddha's statement in the Four Noble Truths. This inner conflict with ourselves is simply an ignorance of our own nature. When we know who we are, we totally accept it. No conflict, no suffering. When you don't know who you are, you suffer. It is the imaginary self. It's the image of ourselves. And the attributing of the natural functioning of life and all the arising of desires and all the stuff that happens, attributing that to that this imaginary image we have of ourselves is what is the cause of suffering. Buddha's solution to the problem of suffering, that was to not get rid of the circumstances that you felt were causing the suffering, but to eliminate the sufferer. There's no sufferer. Who you think you are is the suffering. And that is essentially created out of this inner conflict with ourselves, this inability, this neurological and physiological resistance to simply being what you are. Because to be what you are is to put yourself in danger. That this is really how it works, folks. You know, I kind of urge you to look into it. Oh, my goodness, 4:53 already. Oof, whoa. Man. What does a past life mean if you wished to be strong? You may be strong or you may be in a life wishing you were strong. Really, the path of trying to create your next life by making all sorts of conditions in this one, it's a total waste of time. The Emperor of China, after having a conversation with the Bodhidharma who brought Zen to China, asked him, he says, I've done all these great things. And he built temples, all sorts of things. He says, what merit shall I receive? You know, the Emperor wanted to know what merit, and Bodhidharma says, no merit. He says, no merit? Well, then what's the meaning of these holy teachings? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing holy. No merit. Don't seek merit. Seek what this moment needs. Be present in this moment. Be the peacemaker in this moment. Just be what this moment needs. Forget what it will bring you. Forget what the next life is. Be here. Because whether there's a past life or not, whether it's childhood trauma or not, it means nothing, because the only thing you're experiencing is what is right here, right now. That's the only thing you ever experience. And even if the past is 10,000 years old, you're experiencing it now. Right now, the impulses, the feelings, the assumptions, all of it right now. It's all right here for you now. You don't need to worry about the past. Everything you need is right here in this moment. Be present with it. Be accepting of it. Be loving towards it. And it will take care of you. So, that's it for this week, folks. As always, thank you for being here. I absolutely love being here, and I hope you loved the show. I hope you liked it about this particular subject. And if there are other subjects you want me to address, that's what I'm here for. The nature of satsang is to meet the questions of those that have them. So this was a result of somebody asking me specifically to talk about it, and that's where it came from. So I hope you'll join me next week, same time, same place, same everything. In the meantime, until next week then, I wish you all well, and namaste.